Yeah, I'm out at Brooklyn. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow.
Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Spencer Schneider, and he is the author of Manhattan Cult Story, My Unbelievable True Story of Sex, Crimes, Chaos, and Survival. The book is available now everywhere, and it's a fascinating read into an incredibly interesting tale of basically a cult right in the middle of Manhattan. And Spencer, as I welcome you in here, it's not illegal to belong to a cult. And so what was the situation with this cult that was known simply as school?
Well, first of all, Brian, thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's not illegal to be in any kind of group, really, that's, you know, not a criminal enterprise if you're participating in it. But what this was basically what I thought I was joining was a, you know, self-improvement group that met a couple of nights a week. And talked about philosophy and tried to apply that, you know, philosophy to improve your life.
You were are a lawyer and right. Were a lawyer at the time. You were a philosophy major, though, and so the philosophers you were studying, were they anybody that you had ever heard of before?
No, that's a good point. I hadn't heard of them, and although that did, you know, surprise me, I also thought it was interesting to learn about new philosophers. The philosophers were Russian mystics, Uspensky and Gurdjieff, who were, you know, popular in the 60s, in that kind of counterculture world.
So what time period are we talking that you got involved with school?
I got involved in 1989, before they had an internet and before you had any way to really investigate these things without going to the public library. I was 29. It was, you know, a period of my life where I was working very, very hard. And I was, you know, looking to have more fun in my life than just, you know, 9 to 5. Well, it was more like 9 to 9 as a young lawyer. That's when I got started, late in the 80s.
So these meetings, they were taking place in, was that a loft in Tribeca, if I remember right?
Yes, exactly. We met in a, you know, this nondescript place in Tribeca in Lower Manhattan. It was rather informal, which was appealing. And it was about 60 people in a group and a couple of leaders. And, you know, 2 nights a week. It didn't seem like anything strange to me at first. It really didn't.
Was it more like a book club?
Pretty much, yeah. Like a book club plus, because it kind of had this element where, you know, there was sort of like a group therapy thing going on. It wasn't heavy at first, but it was more like helpful hints about, you know, social life and, you know, your love life and your work life, nothing really that heavy, you know?
I know it was a while before you met them, but who were the leaders of school?
Right. So the main leader was a woman named Sharon Gans, who just introduced herself as Sharon, but I had no way to know really anything about her because, you know, she had a history which she kept secret. Everything was secret about the group. We kept the secret, the group secret from our families. We didn't tell anybody. I mean, that was a condition. But Sharon kept a lot of secrets from us. We didn't know that she had been an actress and that she had been in San Francisco years before coming to New York and had a group that was accused of being a cult and a lot of abuse, and that she came to New York and refounded her group in a different, you know, in a much more secretive way. So I didn't know any of that stuff until much later on.
What was the money aspect of it? How much did it cost you to join?
Yeah, it was a few $100 a month. I should point out they're still around, and I think they charge $400 or $500 a month now to folks. But there were other amount, and they called that tuition because we called ourselves school. But eventually, you know, that amount grew because we paid for other things towards the group.
There had to be something that you were getting out of it personally as you were there. And so did it feel like it was worth it to you as you began your journey with them?
Yeah, definitely. That, you know, in the beginnings, they really, really make it valuable to you. So I found these great friends who really cared about me in a way that I'd never felt before, and that they got involved in, you know, all kinds of parts of my life that you just didn't talk about with people, you know. So I found this very supportive community, which I think everybody wants, you know. Who wouldn't want that, you know? So it wasn't really, it was all a positive from that point of view. And in coming back and thinking about my life in this group, it was very hard to come back to those positive things, and because there's a real conflict with all the pain that created for me. So it's a good question that I had to answer for myself.
What was the point in your experience that you all of a sudden realized this was not a good thing and it was a bad thing? Was it early on, or did it take you years?
It took years. I would say halfway through. Like, I was there 23 years, and about halfway through, a lot of my friends left, and the leader really took a much more darker way in, but by then I was really hooked into the group, and like a lot of people involved in abusive relationships or cults, it's really hard to get, really, really hard, because it's your whole world.
What takes something from being just a group of people, a support group essentially, or a book club type atmosphere,
right,
what takes it out of that realm and makes it something that we think of as a cult?
That's a great question, because it's not so simple. And I have, you know, thought about this a lot. I think the defining factor is a leader, a charismatic leader, who in the end of the day exploits people for their own personal benefit. And that's exactly what the situation was. And it took a while to figure that out, because I always thought this leader was helping me and giving me things. But when I really needed things from her on my conditions, they weren't there. And I had given so much to her and lost a lot. So it was it's like a one-sided relationship to the extreme.
I'm chatting with Spencer Schneider about his brand new book, Manhattan Cult Story, My Unbelievable True Story of Sex, Crimes, Chaos, and Survival. It's available everywhere. Spencer, one of the most interesting things, well, there were several interesting things, but one of the most interesting things is something that took place at the legendary Gleason's Gym in New York City. This whole boxing aspect. Can you kind of tell me about what that experience was like? That was so out of the norm for me to think about.
Yeah, well, thanks for asking about that. Not a lot of people do. We were, the men in the group given, we thought, like, the opportunity to learn to box. And it actually was fun. We went down to Gleason's Gym once a week on Friday nights, and we learned from great people how to box, and we did. And we did fights, and it was fun to learn how to do that. I mean, we were all kind of older, and it wasn't like we were teenagers or 20-year-olds. You know, we were just learning this thing. But the interesting and sad part of it was that, you know, people would get hurt. And I did, a lot of guys did. And they really discouraged us from, you know, going to the doctor. Because they felt that, you know, it was good for, you know, character building, to just take the pain and not, you know, seek treatment. And we didn't really have appropriate protective gear either. So that was an unfortunate byproduct of that experience.
When you were involved in the cult, I know you had essentially an arranged marriage. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
How did that come about?
Well, I had been discouraged from dating people who weren't in the group, and the leader had tried to, you know, set me up with people, and eventually she really pushed, someone who was a friend and I really liked and respected, and really pushed her to push me to, you know, get involved with her. And, you know, I was so under the influence of the leader that I just, you know, complied. You know, somebody I respected a lot, and she said, oh, this is a really good thing for you. You really ought to do it. And I did. And we had many happy years together, but a lot of unhappy years also.
Was it a matter of that you, I mean, did you feel like it was of your own free will that you were doing it, or were you essentially forced into it?
Absolutely felt like that. Everything felt like my own free will, but it really wasn't. Because when you look back on it, there were so many things that coerced you to do things like, you know, working around the clock for free, labor for the leader, giving so much money. There was nothing about free will. In fact, we were encouraged from giving up our free will and giving up our will to our leaders. I mean, that was a tenet of being in the group.
I've noticed as I've talked to you, you call Sharon Gans the leader. You don't use her name. Is that a certain conscious thing you do because of the pain that it causes?
No, not at all. Not at all. No. It doesn't.
Was this completely a money thing for her?
Yeah, it was. It was 90. Well, I would say mostly, not maybe 70% money, and then the other 30% was this sort of need that she had to have power over people and get this sort of adulation, which she demanded of people. She loved attention. Very narcissistic person. So I think it was a combination, but more of the money. And she made a lot. You know, it was over $1 million a year in cash. And she lived, and died last year in the Plaza Hotel. She had a condo there.
When she died, did you feel anything?
Very mixed feelings. I felt guilty being glad she was gone because I thought that would help a lot of people get out of this group and it would mean the end of the group. The group still continues, you know. It was a mixed feeling when she passed away. Because I had a lot of good feelings about her. But she hurt so many people and ruined a lot of lives, you know. So in the end, it's for the better. She lived a long life. She was 85.
I know you tell a story in the book about how you got out, but was it cold turkey for you?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. I mean, you leave and you're gone and you're ostracized, which is another telltale sign of a cult. The ostracized people wouldn't talk to you anymore if from the group and you were nothing to them. But I had to start all over.
When you say start all over, emotionally, financially?
Yeah, everything. Because I was cut off from a business partner that I had who was in the group. And he no longer wanted to work with me, so I had to start my business again, friendships from scratch, and get over the emotional trauma that I had, which was significant, and that took a lot of work, a lot of time.
Is there any certain stigma that is attached to having been a member of the cult? I mean, we're in 2022, because the most famous cult, I think, is the Manson family, and that was a totally different situation. And so people think, God, how can these people get involved in this? Is there any stigma attached to it today?
I thought there was when I got out, and that's why I didn't want to talk about it, and that's why a lot of people don't want to talk about it. But I don't think so. I mean, I wrote a book about it. I've talked about this a lot, and I've had nothing but good support and, no critics. I think people say, oh, well, how could you get involved in that? And then when I explain it to people, they're like, oh, I get that. I could see that happening. And I also think the environment's different now. We've seen so many of these other groups that are not like the Manson, like NXIVM and Scientology and others, how they, you know, they're not necessarily like blowing up, you know, violent like that, you know, but they do abuse people in their cults. So I think there's less of a stigma now. And that's one of the reasons I'm talking out about it, because I don't think people should be stigmatized. They're victims. They're not willing to be, you know, abused.
All right. Well, I know it's a cautionary tale, and you include some, toward the end of the book, you include 9 telltale signs you're in a cult and discuss all of that. It's just a fascinating read, and it's almost an you admit it's an unbelievable true story, because it happens right in the greatest city in the world. The book is Manhattan Cult Story, My Unbelievable True Story of Sex, Crimes, Chaos, and Survival by Spencer Schneider. The book is available everywhere. Spencer, just an amazing tale. I'm glad you shared it as a cautionary tale to everyone, and I thank you for joining me to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian. It was a lot of fun.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.